Okay, we're in Romans chapter 1. We began 2 weeks ago by introducing the book. Last week we looked at the first 13 verses of chapter 1 and compared those 13 verses with the last chapter and a half of the book and tried to see how there's kind of a bookend effect to how the book begins and how the book ends. A lot of similarities, but the focus of the book is really about the justification that one can have in the sight of God, and that only comes through obedience to the gospel. And so we're going to see that. We're going to pick up in verse 14 this morning. We got through the first 13 verses last week. We're going to pick up in verse 14, and we're going to see that in this section right here is where we have the major theme of the book introduced to us, and we have the key verses that are mentioned here. But back up in chapter 1, about the first six verses, we saw Paul and his relationship to the gospel, how he was separated to preach the gospel. And then about verse 7 down through verse 13, we saw Paul and his relationship to the Romans, to the Roman Christians, and how much of a close bond that he had with these people, even though he had never been there. When we saw last week in chapter 16, how he listed 26 people by name and various greetings that he sent. And so obviously, he was very familiar with a lot of folks who were there. But we start in verse 14 this morning in Paul's relationship to his task of evangelism. And you have in verses 14, 15, and 16 what you've often seen in this study, the three I am statements of Paul in regards to the gospel. He says in verse 14, I am a debtor, both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. What does that mean that he's a debtor? Had he taken out some loans? There was an obligation that he had. And it was not just an obligation that he had. There was an obligation that he felt to these individuals to take the gospel to them. He remembered what the Lord had done for him. And he remembered how much they needed the Lord and how much they needed the gospel. And so he says, I feel an obligation. Now, to who? To Greeks and to barbarians, to wise and unwise. Why does he list them like that in those particular groups? I'm a debtor to everybody. If you're a debtor to preach the gospel to the wise and the unwise, who does that include? That's everybody, right? Because you're either wise or you're not wise, and everybody in between. He says, I'm a debtor to those who are cultured, the Greeks, and to the barbarians, the uncultured. He says, I feel an obligation to go and to preach the gospel to all of these. And so he says in verse 15, so as much as is in me, I'm ready to preach the gospel. I'm not just a debtor. I'm not just obligated to do it. I am ready to go and to preach the gospel to those who are in Rome also. And obviously, there were Christians already there who needed continued teaching in the gospel, and obviously there were other people there who had never heard the gospel, and that's who he wanted to reach. And so he says, I'm ready to go there and preach the gospel. Of course, he didn't realize how long it would take him to get there, didn't realize that he would be arriving there as a prisoner rather than as he often did on his missionary journeys. But in verse 16 and 17, you probably know verse 16 maybe better than any other verse in the book of Romans. There's a lot of verses that you would be familiar with, but probably Romans chapter 1 and verse 16 may be a verse that you've already memorized, maybe from just hearing it so frequently, or maybe you've taken time. But I would encourage you to memorize verse 16, but not just verse 16. We do not understand the fullness of verse 16 without verse 17. And I would encourage you to group those two verses together in your study, because Paul says, not only am I a debtor in verse 14 and I'm ready in verse 15, but I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Do you see that in the life of Paul? That he was not ashamed? Here was a man who believed the gospel. Here was a man who loved it. He proclaimed it. He defended it. He was persecuted for it, and eventually he would die for it. He's not ashamed of it. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Well, what is it? It is the power of God. What was there something special about Paul's power to preach the gospel? Well, Yes, there was, but that's not what made the gospel special. What set the gospel apart was that it was the power of God for what purpose? To bring about salvation. To bring about salvation for who? For everybody. Everybody who believes. And so the gospel is intended to go and to be preached to everybody. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to who? Everybody, every creature. And so the gospel is intended to be preached to everyone because God wants all men to be saved. But who is it that God saves? Those, according to this verse, those who believe. Now, don't take that verse, don't take that word believes out of the context of what we've already seen in the book of Romans. Look back up to verse 5, and we'll see this again. Through him we have received grace and apostleship for obedience of faith, or for obedience to the faith. That's the first time we read about faith or belief in this book. And God ties faith and obedience together. And last week we tied that verse in with chapter 16, verse 26 at the end of the book that has the same expression. And throughout this book, God emphasizes that the faith that saves is the faith that obeys. And so when he says that the gospel is intended for salvation for everybody who believes, he's not talking about a belief that's simply something that is just a mental assent or a feeling that somebody has in their heart. But this is a faith that is in its completeness and its fullness and leads somebody to obedience. Why does he say for the Jew first and also for the Greek? Why does he say Jew first? It was given to them first. When Peter stood up and preached on the day of Pentecost, think about it. He stood up in Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish world, as you might say, and he stood up on the day of Pentecost. Why did he choose the day of Pentecost? Because that was one of the great feast days of the Jews, when millions of Jews would be there, and he preached the gospel to those Jews who were gathered there. And for the first 10 or so years, that's who the gospel was preached to. Not because it was designed only for them, but it was intended to go to them first. When God had made a covenant with the house of Moses, with Moses, made a covenant with Moses and with his people, the Jews, God formed a special relationship between him and that Jewish nation. What did he say to Abraham? Through your seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. Well, we know that God intended that word seed to have a capital S. Through your seed, talking about Jesus, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. But where was that seed going to come from? It's going to come from his lowercase seed, lowercase S, from his Jewish Hebrew heritage. And so God used the Jewish nation to bring about Christ into the world, and the gospel was preached to them first, but then it was also preached to the Gentiles. Look at verse 17. For in it, in what? In the gospel. For in it, the word it is the gospel. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. God's plan. What is the righteousness of God? God's plan to make man right. That's the righteousness of God described here. God's plan to make man right was revealed to man in the gospel, from faith to faith. What does that expression mean? We don't know exactly what that means. It could have a variety of meanings. What does it mean that it was revealed from faith to faith? It could be talking about that the gospel was revealed to take you from one level of faith to a higher level of faith, from a weak faith to a stronger faith. It could be talking about that the gospel was revealed from faith, God's objective faith, the faith, to create faith in someone's heart. Why did God give the gospel? In order to make man right with him. And then this quotation from the book of Habakkuk at the end of verse 17. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. I think usually when we read that statement, we think that it's talking about the fact that of how we live and that we should live by faith. And that is a true statement, that as Christians we should live by faith. But the Greek, the way that the Greek structures this, and the fact that this is a future tense verb on the idea of living here, this is really talking about the person who is made just by faith shall live. The person who is made righteous by faith shall live. It's talking about future tense, someone who is set apart for God's purposes, somebody who is made right with God by his faith on this earth, he shall live eternally. That statement is Romans in a nutshell. Verse 17 is the book of Romans. And if you can get verse 17, you get the book of Romans, what it's all about. Because the book of Romans is about when someone by faith is justified, when someone by faith is made righteous in the eyes of God, that's the person who will live eternally. So what is the book of Romans about? It's about teaching how does one become righteous. How is one justified in the eyes of God? And it's only done through the gospel, and it's only done through one's obedience to the gospel of Christ. And that's verses 16 and 17. Dirk? That may be tied in. This expression that the gospel is revealed to make man right with God, reveals the righteousness of God from faith to faith. Obviously in the gospel, you know, what when this same book in Romans chapter 10 and verse 17, where does faith come from? Faith comes from hearing the word of God. And so if faith comes from hearing the word of God is often described as the faith. It is Jude describes it as the faith that was once for all delivered. Well, in this same book that's described as the faith, we read about the faith of others. We do read about the faith of Abraham and the faith of Noah and the faith of those righteous in the Old Testament. And perhaps that helps to create our own faith. And we'll read about Abraham's faith when we get to chapter 4 here. But I would encourage you to memorize verses 16 and 17 and not stop our memorization with verse 16, but tie verse 17 in it, because it says, here's what the gospel does. The gospel reveals to us how we are able to get right with God and to stay right with God so that we can live with God for eternity. Any other comments about those verses, 14 through 17? Look in verse 18. What's the first word you have in verse 18? For. That's a key word when you study the Bible, because it ties this verse with what's already been said. And it says that something has been revealed. Now, verse 17 told us that something is revealed. The righteousness of God is revealed in verse 17. When we have the gospel, it's God telling us how to get right with him. Why do we need to know how to get right with God? Well, because obviously we're not right with God. So when you get to verse 18, you're actually entering into really the body, the fullness of the book of Romans. The first 17 verses are all introduction. It's the longest introduction of any of Paul's epistles is here in the book of Romans. 17 verses of introduction. And it's down to verse 18 where you finally get to some of his main argumentation. What he's going to do, and starting in verse 18, and it's going to go through chapter 3 and verse 20, is his first major line of discussion. And what he's presenting in chapter 1, verse 18 through chapter 3 and verse 20 is that everybody needs the gospel. And the key word in this is this idea of sin, and that there's a need for God's righteousness because of sin. And so what he's going to do in this chapter, verse 18 down through the end of this chapter, is he's going to talk about the Gentiles. So chapter 1, verse 18 through 32, he's going to talk about the Gentiles who are sinners. And so what do they need? They need the gospel. Then you're going to get to chapter 2. And from chapter 2 and verse 1 down through chapter 3 and about verse 8, he's going to focus on the Jews. He doesn't want the Jews to think that this letter is only written to the Gentiles. So he takes from chapter 2 down through chapter 3 and verse 8, and he focuses on the Jews, and he represents the Jews as equally needing the gospel as the Gentiles are. And this whole thrust of sin is there in that discussion of the Jews, and that they need God's righteousness as much as the Gentiles do because of their sin. And then when you get to chapter 3 and verse 9, and go down through about chapter 3 and verse 20, he opens it up to everybody. Starts with the Gentiles in chapter 1, chapter 2 and first part of chapter 3 of the Jews, and then chapter 3, verse 9 through 20, he focuses in on everybody and says everybody is in need of the righteousness of God because everybody has sin and they need the gospel. So with that kind of an overview of where he's going to go with this, come back to chapter 1 verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. What do you think about when you read that? The wrath of God is revealed. You know, sometimes people hear about the wrath of God and they equate that to, the wrath of their mother when they were growing up, or the wrath of their father when they were growing up. And so they hear the word wrath and they think about the uncontrolled anger and fussing and fighting and cussing and just having an all-out hissy fit that maybe they saw in somebody growing up. Is that the wrath of God? When we read about the wrath of God, are we reading about some uncontrolled anger? No, we're not. And in fact, we're not even reading so much about an emotional response from God. When we think about human wrath, we're thinking about an emotional response. When we read about the wrath of God, it's not. I'm not saying that it's divorced from God's emotions, but it's not based upon emotions. It's based upon law. And when God's law is broken, what then is revealed? The wrath of God. That's what this is talking about. He's talking about all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men in this context. And what is he saying is revealed against that is the wrath of God. You might think of the wrath of God as being like a holy hostility against sin. It's not that he's out of control angry. Not it at all. It is that law has been broken, and the breaking of law has consequences. When we break God's laws, are the consequences going to be good? No. Is that something that we're going to warm up to and think is just a great idea, is to experience the consequences of breaking God's law? No. Because what comes is the wrath of God is described here against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. And really those two concepts, while we might consider them the same, ungodliness and unrighteousness, really they're describing two different things. The idea of ungodliness is describing somebody's attitude towards God and how somebody might have a disrespectful, irreverent attitude towards God, ungodliness. But the idea of unrighteousness, and the reason he uses two words, the idea of unrighteousness really focuses in on somebody's attitude towards man and how he regards man and perhaps treats man with injustice. And so God's wrath, the consequences that come upon man, have to do with what he thinks about God, his attitude towards God, and his attitude towards his fellow man. And so what has man done at the end of verse 18? They suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Let me ask you a question about the Gentiles. Were the Gentiles under the law of Moses? Did the Gentiles were they in the covenant relationship with God that the Jews were because of what happened at Mount Sinai? Okay, that's true. So did the Gentiles then, did they not have a law? Did they have no law? Were they free from law and then could whatever they wanted to do? No, that's not true. If the Gentiles didn't have that covenant relationship with God, the Jews did. Did they even know God? Maybe they didn't know God. Maybe they didn't know what God wanted from them. And so they could do anything. No, okay. I didn't know if you had a half comment or not. Okay, he was only raising his hand halfway, so I didn't want to ignore it. As we get into this book, we're going to see how Paul deals with the Gentiles and the Jews and the fact that both of them were accountable to God. Even though one was in a covenant relationship with God through the law of Moses, the Gentiles were just as much accountable to God for what they knew of God. Now, I want you to look at that word know, or the word truth and the word know. The end of verse 18, they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. What does that mean? It means the Gentiles knew something of the truth of God. They had knowledge of God. Well, how could they have knowledge of God? Verse 19, because what may be known of God is manifest, is evident. Some translations might have the word plain. What might be known of God is evident, plain, and manifest. Where? In them. For God has shown it to them. He has literally exposed this to them. How could they know God? This says that God made it plain to them. God made it evident to them. Well, what does that mean? What's the first word you have in verse 20? For. How did God make it manifest within them, to them, in them, depending on the preposition you have in verse 19? For. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes. Can you see something that's invisible? His invisible attributes are clearly seen. Excuse me, how can you see something that's invisible? Being understood by the things that are made. Oh, wait a minute. Can you see things that are made? Evidence. There's evidence. If you can see the things that are made, can you see the trees? Can you see the trees that fell off of your... Can you see the branches that fell off of your trees and were laying in your yard? When you came out on Friday morning, was there evidence that something had transpired during the night? Not as much evidence as we were told there was going to be there, but there was some sort of evidence, I believe, right? For most of you. When we see the things that are made, what does verse 20 say? We are able to clearly see the invisible God. But not just know that there is a God. What does this verse say? Clearly seeing, being understood by the things that are made, even not just that there is a God, but that we can know His eternal power and His divine nature to the point that we and they are without excuse. The heavens declare, Psalm 19 says what? The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows His handiwork. Here is the creation of God shouting that God exists. But not just that God exists. Shouting the eternal power of God. How else would all of this come into existence than by someone who has power? What kind of power? A power that is unmeasurable. If you can't even measure the universe, can you measure the power that created that universe? You can't even measure it. It is an eternal power. And not only can we know His eternal power, we can know, the New King James and other translations have the word Godhead. Some translations have this concept of divine nature. We can know that there is a God in heaven just by looking at creation. That's powerful. And so here are the Gentiles. And what had God done? God had revealed Himself to them. He had made Himself known to them. Not through Mount Sinai, not through the law of Moses, but through His creation. They knew who He was. And as we're going to see through this chapter, when you know who God, when you know there is a God, there are consequences for violating God's will. We're going to see that in a minute. Henry?
Yeah, the word made plays a big part in this. You know, made.
Yeah. Well, and that's...
That plays a big part in this.
Right, right. Well, that's... In the beginning, God did what? Created the heavens and the earth. That's this idea of Him, of the things that are being made. And the emphasis here is that from what's made, we can see and know there is a God to the point that we are without excuse. So what happened? What transpired with the Gentiles then? They turned away from God. And what you're going to see starting in verse 21 is you're going to see kind of their steps to their apostasy, their steps to turning away from God. Verse 21, because although they knew God, well, how can they know God? He just told them. You've known God because He made it clearly manifest and plain to you through creation. And so they knew God, but verse 21 says they did not glorify Him as God. They did not glorify Him as the Creator. They did not recognize Him as having all authority. They did not recognize Him as the one to whom they needed to submit. And so they didn't glorify Him as God. Well, when you don't glorify God as God, what does that also lead you to do? You're not very thankful to Him, are you? If you don't believe God is God, well, you're not very thankful to that God. And then verse 21 says, but they became futile in their thoughts. They came to the point where they were completely hopeless in leading themselves. They were proud and lifted up, though, and their foolish hearts, the end of verse 21, their foolish hearts were darkened. They thought they were something, but they weren't. They were vain. At the same time, they were blind, and now they're empty because they're walking in darkness. Verse 22, professing to be wise, they thought they were something. They claimed a superior wisdom. But if you claim a superior wisdom and don't acknowledge God, what does that make you? Well, what does verse 22 say? They claimed a superior wisdom, but they refused God's wisdom, and so they became fools. Seems like there's a verse in the Bible that says, the blank has said in his heart, there is no God. Who does? Oh, they became fools, because what? Oh, we're not subject to any kind of a God. Verse 23, they exchanged, and I want us to see that verse, that word as we go through here. They exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God. I want you to see these steps that are leading them away from God. Did not glorify Him as God. They were not thankful. They became futile in their thoughts, foolishness in their hearts. They thought they were something, but they became foolish. And so what did that lead them to do? That led them to exchange the glory of the incorruptible God and make it into an image made like corruptible man. Birds, four-footed animals, and creeping things. You know, man is built as a worshiping creature. There is inside of every created human being an innate desire, longing to worship. And so what did these individuals do? When they rejected God and worshiping God, well, we will just go and make ourselves a God. How foolish do you have to be to take that piece of stone, to take that piece of wood, and to carve it, and to get it exactly how you want it, to spend hours and hours and hours fashioning this idol, and then to bow down to something you just made and call that your God. How foolish do you have to be? Well, when you turn away from the God and you say, I don't want anything to do with that God, what are you? You're a fool. And what is that going to lead you to do? All sorts of foolish things. To the point that somebody would take a bird. This verse says, take a bird and worship a bird. Really? Well, that's what you're going to do. If you don't believe in God, you are going to exchange the glory of God into some kind of into something that is made with man's hands and deify the lowest of things. Now, verse 24. What's the first word you have in verse 24? Therefore, I want you to. Some people get caught up on this idea in verse 24. God gave them up. In verse 26, God gave them up. In verse 28, God gave them up or gave them over. Some people get tripped up on those three statements. Well, God gave them up? What does it mean, God gave them up? That's not very fair of God to give somebody. Wait a minute. What had they done? They gave up on God. They gave God over to not worship and didn't want to have anything to do with God. They wanted nothing to do with God. Verse 24 says, therefore God gave them up to do what they wanted to do. Is God going to force an individual to do something against their will? You're going to force them to serve Him, worship Him, love Him, adore Him, believe in Him? No. And if they are longing and just as headstrong to go down a path where they exchange the glory of God into some kind of a man-made image, okay. Therefore, God gave them up to their uncleanness. Notice how this moves from their religious the part of their lives, from their idolatry and their worshiping part of their lives, and how the consequences now lead into the immorality in their hearts. God gave them up to uncleanness in the lust of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies. When you dishonor God, what's that going to lead you to do with your body? Well, they dishonored their bodies among themselves. So verse 23 says, they exchanged the glory of God. What did they do in verse 25? They exchanged the truth of God. They wanted nothing to do with God's glory in verse 23. Verse 25, they exchanged the truth of God. They wanted nothing to do with God's truth. Well, when you exchange the truth of God, what are you left with? A lie. If you say, I don't want the truth of God, there's only one thing left. You got a bunch of lies. If you don't want the truth, so there is a major difference between these. And so they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And when they did that, what did they do? Worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. How ignorant and foolish do you have to be? And Paul says, the Creator who is blessed forever. It doesn't matter whether or not they blessed God or praised God. He's blessed forever regardless of what man does. He is the Almighty God, worthy of all of our praise, and He is worthy whether we give it to Him or not. Verse 26, how does this verse begin? For this reason. We're going to see God gave them up to vile passions, but why did God give them up to vile passions? For this reason. What reason? They're over there not worshiping the Creator. They're over there worshiping creatures. They've given their lives over to immorality. And so what did God do? For that reason, God gave them up to their vile passions. If that's where they want to live, then that's where God's going to let them live. You know, man becomes like the God that he worships. Would you think about that for a second? Man becomes like the God that he worships. If I worship the one true and living God, I will become more and more like Him. If I worship an animal, what am I going to become like? An animal. That's what I'm going to become like. I will become an animal. And that's what this is saying, Morris. Right. And that's why at the end of verse 25, he's talking about the fact that these people worshiped and served. And both those go together. You worship and you serve your God, and when you worship and serve an animal, that's what you will be. And there's really only, those are only the options. If you don't worship and serve the one and true and living God, then you're going to go in another direction, and that's what you're going to become. And so God gave them up to their vile passions in verse 26. For even their women, give me a second, Henry, I've only got 5 minutes. I got a lot of verses to cover here. For even their women did what? Exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Have you seen three times this word exchanged? Verse 23, what'd they do? Glory of God, exchanged it. No, we don't want that. We want something else. We want this idol. Verse 25? They exchanged the truth of God. Oh, no, we don't want the truth of God. We'll just take these lies over here. Now, verse 26, what are they doing? Exchanging what God created. He's the creator in verse 25, right? He's the creator of male and female. In verse 26, what are they doing? Exchanging the natural way God created man for what? What was against nature. We don't want the way God made it. We don't want this male-female relationship. That's what God made. So they exchanged that for a female-female relationship, for a male-male relationship that God says is against nature. It is not the natural use. It is not the natural function. You might have that word there. Or the natural relations. What does that mean? You weren't made that way. You weren't born that way. Because that's not the way God made man. Likewise, verse 27, likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing. I want you to see, how does God describe the homosexual relationship here? Committing what is shameful or indecent, maybe some translations say, receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due to them. These are God's words to describe how He views the homosexual relationship. Down in verse 28, He's going to talk about how it is something that is not fitting.
David,
yes.
Does that mean in a physical way or in a spiritual way?
Both. It's going to be both. But no doubt it is especially intended to be talking about physically, because it's talking about receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due. That obviously there is a spiritual component to that. Obviously there's an eternal component to that. But what have we seen historically that has come about because of homosexual relationships? Are there certain things that have come about, diseases that individuals have suffered because of those particular relationships? And notice that this concept of what a man sows, that's what he's going to reap, is involved here. And so verse 28 says, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, even as they chose not to retain God, what did God do? God gave them over. God doesn't give them over unless they themselves make that decision. So God gave them over to a debased mind, to do those things that are not fitting. If somebody, there's a moral cause and effect law here that if somebody rejects God, what's going to happen? God's going to reject them. And you dishonor God, you're going to dishonor your body, and you'll dishonor your fellow men. So verse 29 says, being filled with all unrighteousness. Notice the superlatives, filled with it. All unrighteousness. And that's talking about one's relationship with his fellow man. Let's read through these verses as we finish. What was involved? Sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, insolent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. Think about all of that. Where did all of that come about? You turn your back on God. What's that going to lead you to? All of those things. Who, knowing the righteous judgment of God... They know this. They know God. They know that there is a righteous judgment of God. They have seen this transpire during their lifetime. They know it, but what do? That those who practice such things are deserving of death. They're not only doing it, but they're approving of those people who practice it. It is wrong to engage in these sorts of things, but God says it's not just wrong to engage in them. it's wrong to approve of them. And if you approve of them, you are just as wrong as those who practice them. What's he saying? All of this is in here to say the Gentiles need the gospel. The Gentiles are lost in sin, and the Gentiles need the gospel. They need to be saved. A lot more we could have said there, I know that, but we had to rush through. Thank you all so much for your good attention.